This morning, in this part of Focus 580, we'll be talking with Benjamin Barber. He's professor of civil society at University of Maryland and a principal of the Democracy Collaborative. He's an author of a number of books, and one that got a lot of attention came out back in 1995, a book titled Jihad versus Macworld, in which he made this argument that there were two forces at work in the world. That he calls tribalism and globalism, and the shorthand for those two things are Jihad and Macworld in the title. He argues that in most ways these forces are in opposition, yet one thing that they share is a distaste for democracy. The book, as I say, got a lot of positive attention. In fact, one of the people who was oppressed by the book was President Bill Clinton. And as a result, our guest Benjamin Barber got a chance to spend some time in the Clinton circle and in the White House in an advisory kind of capacity. And he has a new book out that's based on that experience, which is titled The Truth of Power. The subtitle is Intellectual Affairs in the Clinton White House. And that book is published by W.W. Norton and is just out just fairly recently here. Also, if you're interested in reading Jihad versus Macworld, that book is still available. It's now out in a paperback edition. It's published by Ballantyne. So that should be in bookstore or by this time perhaps in the library. And as we talk this morning with Benjamin Barber, you should certainly feel free to call in, ask questions, make comments, be a part of the conversation. We welcome that. All we ask is people just try to be brief so we can keep things moving along. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also, we have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Professor Barber, hello.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and thank you very much for talking with us once again. Maybe we might just go back for a moment and ask you to talk about the basic arguments in the book Jihad versus Macworld, because they certainly seem to be relevant to where we are right now.
It's a little too relevant for my taste. I mean, I'm kind of sorry that it's as relevant as it is, but maybe its message will be better received now, and perhaps it will help us respond in more appropriate ways. I wrote personally 8-10 years ago. I started working on this, and I was struck back then by the fact that about half the people writing about the world were saying the world was coming together around technology, around global commerce and world trade, around American pop culture, McDonald's, fast food, fast computers, fast music, MTV. Guys like Fukuyama were talking about the
end of history.
History and capitalism triumphant. The other half, like Robert Kaplan, were saying, no, the world's falling apart. The world's in a state of tribalism, reactionary fundamentalism. And what was clear to me is they were both right. Both things were happening, and they were happening simultaneously. And I tried to write about the way in which the forces of integration and assimilation and globalization around what I called Macworld and the forces of reactionary fundamentalism and tribalism and disintegration around what I called Jihad actually were locked in a kind of battle with one another, in which each of them needed the other, in which they provoked and caused one another, and in which between them there was an insidious effect on democracy, on freedom, and on diversity. So, the notion was that neither Jihad nor Macworld were serving diversity or freedom, and indeed, in the struggle between them, they tended to be destructive of democracy, and that unless we understood, those of us who were devoted to the world of Macworld, the world of global capitalism, the world of global markets, the world of global commerce and global consumerism, unless we understood the kinds of responses it was not only provoking, but to some degree serving and facilitating, we were likely to be locked in a struggle that could get more violent and more difficult and undermine the freedom and democracy of the modern states.
And in trying to understand what happened and what motivated the attacks of September 11th, it has been characterized by many people as being an attack on Westernism and also an attack on modernism. It would seem as if in large part this was an attack on Macworld. Is that the way that you see it?
Well, I think it was an attack on Macworld, although let me be very clear about one thing. I think there's a world of difference between the small circle of terrorists, 18 or 19 here and maybe 100 or 200 here and elsewhere, who provided the supportive framework for terrorism, there's a world difference between what they did and who they are, and the larger third world characterized by despair and anger and resentment. I think we need to make a sharp distinction between them, because the terrorists themselves, after all, were not hungry people. They were not people in poverty. They were fairly well-off people, educated in this case, in fact, and motivated, I think we have to say, by little other than annihilation, really nihilism. They weren't there to negotiate. They weren't saying, if you can increase North-South transfers, if you can create a more just situation in Palestine, we'll call off the terror. I mean, clearly their terror is rooted in a deep nihilism whose only end is destruction. And there's no way to deal with the terrorists themselves other than the way Bush is doing, through, I think, a strong military and intelligence response. But the larger circle in which terrorism operates, which tends to facilitate and nurture it, we've seen pictures of people in third world and Palestinian and West Bank and Pakistani and Afghan cities cheering the terrorist results. That's a different story. I mean, there you have people who are not trying to destroy modernity but join it. There you have people who don't want to destroy the global economy but have an opportunity to participate in it. And their situation is one which, up until now, we have not really begun to address. And I think, in a sense, the lessons of Jihad versus McWorld are that unless we begin to address this world of global markets, global capitalism, and address the despair, the anger, the resentments, and above all, the hopelessness of so many young people in the rest of the world, we're going to continue to have a breeding ground for terrorism such that no matter what we do with bin Laden and his associates, let's assume we get them all and eliminate them, we're still going to face the prospects of terrorism in the years to come.
Now, you certainly touched on something that I have thought about and not really even been quite sure how it is to talk about, to what sort of terms to use. But I guess I myself was very struck, and again, thinking about what happened in September, when one starts to think about political motivation, I guess I was left feeling with the fact that this was not a political act, that it wasn't a political act.
No, I think that's right. It was an act against the very idea of politics. I mean, politics is how we negotiate our differences and try to create, you know, justice. And sometimes people who are on the outside use violence as a part of the political system, as a threat, as an incentive, or even as a manifestation of their despair. But usually violence under those circumstances is aimed at trying to change something. And, you know, it was one of the tragedies here was that the good men who piloted those four airplanes clearly surrendered their seats to the terrorists, thinking that this was a standard negotiation. And, you know, they had been trained to accommodate hijackers, to put the safety of their passengers above all. And, you know, they obviously thought these guys were going to take the planes and land them somewhere, and then they'd enter into a negotiation. But the perfect proof that there was no negotiation was that all these terrorists wanted to do was use the planes as bombs, and they did that. I mean, so there's no negotiating directly with these people. But that's not to say that America is not itself, to a degree, involved in the creation of a world which in turn has made a situation in which sharp north-south differences, rich-poor differences, mean that over half the world really sees America as part of its problem, sees us, maybe unfairly, but it's a fact. I mean, we have to take the fact, sees us as the ones who have created a world which gives their children no opportunities. The generational divide here is very powerful. In Pakistan, for example, half of Pakistan's population is under 16, and an awful lot of them, you know, are hungry. Palestine, same thing. Much of the third world, the demographic curves, you know, favor the young. And even in our first world cities like L.A. and Phoenix, New York, and Chicago, you know, a lot of the population is young, multicultural, and poor. And that's a devastating reality which creates issues that if we do not begin to address them, I think even if we lick terrorism in the first front war that Bush is conducting, are going to mean a couple of years from now, there'll be a whole new generation of terrorists and a whole new generation of problems, even more intractable than the current one. So I think we really are compelled to conduct a two-front campaign, a campaign that has a strong and effective military and intelligence front right now, but a campaign that also opens simultaneously a civic and political and, if you like, a democratic front, so that we're interested not just in retributive justice, punishing those who did this ugly and horrible act, but also distributive justice, creating a world where the goods are more equally distributed between North and South, rich and poor, such that there's no climate for terrorism in the future.
Our guest, Benjamin Barber, professor of civil society at University of Maryland, principal of the Democracy Collaborative, author of a number of books. His most recent one that I mentioned at the beginning takes a look at intellectual affairs in the Clinton White House. That's titled The Truth of Power. Also, you might be interested in his book, Jihad versus McWorld, which was first published in 1995, actually based an expanded version of an article that he wrote for The Atlantic magazine. That appeared in March of 1992, and that's still there on their website if you'd just like to go and read a brief version. Also, the book is available in paperback, published by Ballantyne. Questions, comments are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. It seems to be really difficult now at this point to have a reasoned public sort of discussion about all of this. The desire, perhaps understandable and maybe even justified, for justice is so strong that people now are, for those people who are trying to raise the question of past American policies in the world and how that helped to bring us where we are, get shouted down as being un-American somehow, which makes it difficult to have this conversation.
Well, it does, but, you know, part of that is some people, I think, particularly some people on the left, have tried to make it a choice. They've tried to say we shouldn't respond in strategic and military and intelligence terms. We're responsible for the world created, and therefore we have to just do that. And I think that's a mistake. These are not alternative strategies. They are parallel strategies. My own belief is that we need a strong military, a prudent, but a strong military response that does its best to locate and bring to justice the despicable people who actually did this act, a non-negotiated act of nihilism and annihilation. But that there's no reason why simultaneously we can't, not in the interest of some utopian world order, but in the interest of national security, why we shouldn't also treat with the underlying problems. I mean, it reminds me of, you know, people who say one or the other. It's like if you're a smoker and you get cancer. You go to your doctor. Now, if the doctor says, we're going to leave the cancer there, but stop smoking, you know, that would be very foolish. But it would be equally foolish to say, we're going to cut the cancer out with some good surgery and give you some radiation, but don't worry, you can keep smoking. We've got to be concerned both with the tumor, and these terrorists are a kind of cancerous tumor who have to be cut out, but also the conditions that promoted the tumors to grow. And to say that, you know, we can only do one or the other is a foolish kind of civic medicine. We need to do both. We need to cut out the cancer with military and intelligence surgery, but we also need to deal with the underlying conditions that promote the growth of cancerous tumors. And to do so is not unpatriotic, or is not even utopian foolishness. It's the essence of a prudent national security strategy that will enable us to change the conditions and secure ourselves from future terrorist attacks. I mean, that's my goal. Once upon a time, I had an interest in global democracy simply in and of itself. At this point, a more democratic and just global order has become a prerequisite of American national security. And I think people who talk about those issues are just as much patriots as people who rightly talk about the need for swift and effective and just military retribution.
We have several callers to bring into the conversation. We'll start here with someone on a car phone on a line.
Hi,
number four.
John.
Yes, John. Go ahead.
I agree with your guest 100%. I've been so frustrated in conversations with people recently who don't want to hear anything about the geopolitical context of how this happened. They hear any talk of what sounds to them like reasoning behind the attacks as somehow a justification for them. And I find that distressing when it gets translated nationally into things like the really strident denunciations of people like Bill Maher and Susan Sontag. I don't necessarily agree with the specifics of their comments, but this sense that we can't talk about anything that smacks of to some people as justifications when there is obviously no justification for what happened.
Well, I don't know if you want to comment further on that, Professor Barber.
No, I think that's a very useful comment. I think the caller points to the distinction between understanding and clarification on the one hand and making excuses on the other. It's also, I have to say, people like Susan Sontag, with their own kind of intemperate and sort of intrinsically anti-American stances, don't help make a case for a broader understanding. I mean, when Susan Sontag says, you know, things like, you know, America's whole existence has been devoted to impoverishing the rest of the world and so on, and that Americans are directly culpable for what just happened, she begins to sound like some version of Jerry Falwell or Pat Robertson, who you may recall, said right after the attack on New York, themselves sounding like Taliban, that America deserved this, it was the fault of abortionists and gays and the American Civil Liberties Union that this had happened, and this was God's wrath. And in a certain way, there is a certain kind of leftist anti-American who says, you know, this is the wrath of the despairing and the poor on a despicable America about which nothing good can be said. And that, you know, it's too bad, because that gives the super patriots on the one hand and the kind of anti-American anti-patriots on the other create a climate, a kind of Taliban-like climate of extremism in which thoughtful and rational people talk in the way your caller just did, saying, look, you know, there are issues out there that we have to address and face, not just because it's right to do so and moral to do so and just to do so, but in order to protect America. And, you know, I mean, the people I know who have been talking about the wider context are doing it not just because they care about justice, but because they care deeply about America, and they want to see America protected. And a simple way to sum this up is to say the best protection for America against terrorism is a more democratic and just world. And if you can create that, you will have also a much safer world. And God knows what Americans want first of all. I live in New York. What I want first of all is safety. But you can't buy safety with military force alone. You can only buy safety.
One more comment that I'd like to get a reaction from your guest.
Sure.
And that is the analogy, you know, when I think about what happened historically with Germany that facilitated the rise of Hitler and the kind of resentment and poverty that was at work there, nothing about that justifies Hitler or his actions. But it did motivate world leaders to begin to want to construct a post-war order that would that would hopefully prevent the rise of future fascism. And I just wondered if that might be an apt way of thinking about how the U.S. should think about its post-war attitude toward the problems you're talking about.
I think that's entirely appropriate, because, in fact, the aim of the post-war institutions, from the Bretton Woods institutions to the United Nations to the Marshall Plan and the reconstruction of Europe, was a simple premise. And that premise was that the best guard against future totalitarianisms and fascisms was democracy, and that a democratic order in Europe could not flourish without a decent economic order and an order of economic justice. So the whole point of American policy after the war was to, in a sense, open that second front. The first front had been the military front against Hitler, and once that front was secured, America and its allies understood that the second front had to be open. We had to create a democratic Europe, and what's extraordinary is that, in fact, one of our closest allies and one of the most democratic nations there today is Germany. You know, and here's a nation that 50 years ago was filled with Nazis and fascists and had been badly defeated in a war, which has now become a powerfully democratic nation, and as a consequence, a nation insulated internally exactly against the kind of terrorism and so on that we're dealing with. So, I mean, I think the call is exactly right. The second response to Nazism after it had been defeated militarily was to reconstruct Europe in a more just economic and civic and politically democratic order in a way that would save it from fascism and communism in the future. And that has succeeded. I mean, Europe is the most extraordinary example of the power of democratization and of social and economic justice to insulate societies against extremisms of the right and the left, and of fundamentalisms and hyper forms of fascism and communism.
Hmm. Well, you've talked about where in this particular discussion the poles of the debate are, and it seems to be the case with this, as with a lot of other things in American politics, is that we have two probably relatively small, very vocal groups on the poles, and then the nation is somewhere in between. Surveys tell us that the president's getting very high approval ratings, that there's a very high level of support for military action, but I'm not sure that really tells you where the country is in the way that they think about this. I wonder if you have some feeling, and perhaps it only can be a feeling, of indeed where most Americans are on this.
Well, I mean, look, I've done probably 40 or 50 radio and television interviews over the last couple of weeks here and in Europe, And what I found remarkable is that the tenor of discussion, you know, in all different parts of America and in Europe, has been one of what I would call thoughtful prudence. Of course there is anger, of course there is rage, and of course there is a deep human need for some form of retribution and justice to see it done. I mean, thousands and thousands of innocent Americans perished in the Pentagon and in the World Trade Center, and perhaps even worse, you know, four planes were made into human bombs, and they carried people who were utterly innocent, including many babies. That was a horrendous deed, and we all thirst for some meaningful form of retribution, and I think we have a right to that thirst. But what has struck me, even here in New York, where people suffered most directly, is that almost everybody I've talked to has said, as long as they're not provoked by somebody who says, you know, America is the evil empire and has created an evil world and is responsible for everything that happened, if you don't say that, but simply say, but there are causes in the world, there are problems in the world that contribute to and help facilitate these sorts of despicable activities, and we also need to address them. And I think there's been a hunger for this kind of an explanation. And interestingly, even the Bush administration itself has moved in a more prudent direction. The first week, understandably, it talked about retribution, it talked about swift military action. But as the administration itself came to see that there were no easy targets, that there were no visible uniformed enemies, and that even the various governments that might be involved one way or another with, if not harboring, at least rationalizing the activities of terrorists, those were complex things. And as a consequence, we've seen Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, and Colin Powell, the Secretary of the State, and Bush himself begin to utilize a language which talks about partnership, that talks about interdependence, that talks about America's need to adjust to and accommodate to the different realities of nations around the world. There's a wonderful piece yesterday in the New York Times op-ed section by Don Rumsfeld, the Secretary of Defense, saying it's a complicated world. And, you know, different places have to be dealt with in different ways. There's a much greater and new sophistication, a sense of the interdependence of the world, such that I think the government itself is saying, you know, there's a need for thoughtful prudence here, not just swift and random and arbitrary military strikes.
Let's go on. We'll go to a caller in Urbana. This is line one. Hello.
Yes, good morning. I grew up in the 50s, and I recall a phrase that was bandied about a lot then, and it was enlightened self-interest. And that referred to the fact that General Motors might indeed put out a huge quantity of cars, and that people belonged to a union usually who worked there, and the president of GE was talking to the union head and said, you know, we could go robotic, and you guys wouldn't get any union dues. And the union leader said, robots can't buy cars. And so I think the 50s were sort of a case of enlightened self-interest. But I don't see that now. I see the corporations being willing to steal from even America. The jobs went overseas to sweatshops, and Americans were, in many cases, left without viable skills and ways of earning a living. So I see the corporations, you know, squeezing America, squeezing the resources of America. I don't see them engaged in enlightened self-interest. And if they would be willing to decimate American labor as they have in the last 10 years, how in the world would they be willing to bring enlightened democracy and care for the people who work in the third world?
I appreciate those sentiments, but let me say corporations are doing what they're supposed to do. They have one responsibility and one responsibility alone, that's to their shareholders and the profits of their shareholders. Their job is to maximize profits, not to secure the interests of the United States. Let me finish the thought. The savage and brutal capitalism that exists now in the world, that you rightly describe, is not the fault of the capitalists. They did not dismantle the regulatory state. We did that. We voted into power the Reagan administration. We voted in the Bush administration. We voted neoliberal ideology into power. We dismantled the regulatory institutions that oversaw and that civilized and gave capitalism a human face. Then we went on to create an international order in which democracy and regulatory institutions and the rule of law vanished altogether because we thought it served these corporations. We did that. The WTO, for example, the IMF, they are democratic institutions. They represent our government. It's our government that's turned them into instruments of the corporate world. The corporations do what they're supposed to do. They live in the state of nature. They're there to compete with others, to make as much money as they can, and that's it. That's what they do. It's our job to regulate, contain, and civilize them, and we have failed to do that because we have bought the ideology of privatization. I mean, look at what privatization did in the safety area. $5 an hour to people who are uneducated, in many cases from foreign lands, hardly speak the language, to sit and watch the x-ray machines and so on in the airports. Of course, you get what you pay for. In Europe, airport security is a question handled by federal police. It's a federal responsibility, a national responsibility of the government. Here, we privatized it, we outsourced it, and of course, the companies that run the private security firms, they're in it for the profits. They don't care about security, so they paid as little as possible and did as little training as possible. That's a perfect example of privatization. But again, you can't blame the private firms. You have to blame American citizens for creating a government that privatized what should be a federal police function, and we now paid big for that. I think, however, to be a little more positive, what you're now going to see is that a lot of Americans are going to suddenly understand that private corporations can't help them with their public interests and their public goods. On the morning of September 12th, nobody woke up and called Bill Gates and said, "Gee, Bill, can you help us out here? We have a national security problem." Americans recognize that this is something that only American government can do. Suddenly, mayors like Giuliani and governors like Pataki and presidents like Bush became emblems of our need to do things together. So I don't disagree with your analysis of what corporations do, but I think blaming the corporations is really to put the blame in the wrong place. We created for 30 years a neoliberal privatizing order in which our government was downsized, in which even President Clinton, you know, despite many of us saying don't do it, said this is the end of big government. He ended big government without ending big business. Of course big business had the advantage, but that's not big business's problem, it's the government's problem, because it got out of the business of regulating business. And so I want to say that this is our civic, it's our civic mission, it's our civic responsibility to assure a government that takes its regulatory and legal and oversight functions seriously. If we don't do that, if we dismantle our state, don't blame the corporations for doing what they do best, which is making money.
I would like to say that it is corporate money and even money from people above the acknowledged corporate level who have been buying politicians, who have been willing to dismantle the regulatory agencies. So while corporations are doing what they do best, they're also undermining America.
I couldn't agree more, but they're doing that according to laws passed by the Congress, and it's passed by congressmen on both sides of the aisle, progressive as well as conservative ones, who are worried about keeping their incumbency.
I agree.
It comes back to us. And so if you and I vote for politicians who won't vote for campaign finance reform, then don't blame the corporations for buying the politicians, and don't blame the politicians for being bought. Blame ourselves for allowing those guys to stay in Congress. I mean, it comes back to us. It's too easy to scapegoat the corporations or corrupt politicians. This is a democracy when I last looked. We still vote for these folks, and if we insist on voting for them, regardless of these issues, we get, I'm afraid, what we vote for.
It's very hard to influence a large political machine, be it Republican or Democratic. And I'm not one of the people who voted for Nader, so, I'm not a Green Party.
It's very hard, but, democracy's always been hard. It was hard when you lived under the Stuart Kings to, try to create an autonomous parliament. It was hard when you lived under Louis the XVI to create, a revolution of rights. It was hard in 1776 for Americans to, gain their independence. It was certainly hard for people who lived under Soviet rule in the 1980s to break from it. Democracy is hard, but it takes some work by us, and it's much too easy to, you know, to turn and blame it all on the corporations or the government when we, you know, we have that power, and if we don't exercise it, you know, maybe we should start looking to ourselves and the problems that, you know, don't allow us to exercise or prevent us from ourselves exercising the power that we have. And this isn't a way of saying it's okay. I completely agree with your analysis. I think it's deeply corrupt to our system to have big money buying big power. But we are the only ones who can do anything about that. And if we don't, it's not enough simply to scapegoat them and say, oh, well, there go the big corporations again, or there go the corrupt politicians. We've got to bring it back home. It's our responsibility. If terrorism is a wake-up call, it's a wake-up call to the necessity for American citizens to take their political fate back into their own hands and create a kind of government which creates a kind of world in which poverty and hopelessness are not bred, because it's poverty and hopelessness that ultimately in turn breed terrorism.
We just have about 15 minutes, a little bit more than 15 minutes left. I hope the last caller will forgive me for wanting to go on, because the lines are full, and I'd like to give a chance to some other people to have their say. Our guest this morning, Benjamin Barber. He's professor of civil society at University of Maryland and principal of the Democracy Collaborative. The number here is 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our next caller in line is Champagne, line number two. Hello.
Hello. I would like to ask your caller about the Democracy Collaborative and whether they are somehow trying to work with people in the Islamic and Arab world. On the one hand, it's very hard to, and you know, to say, well, you need to change your discourse, or, you know, there's something a little unhelpful about your political and religious discourse as far as perhaps jihad, which might affect these people that are quite young and dissatisfied and see no hope for the future. But is there any effort to help people who want to change or present some kind of a counter religious discourse, which I'm sure there are. I mean, I know there are from personal acquaintances in the Arab and Islamic world in terms of, I mean, of education. I guess the thing I'm concerned about is I know that there are all these people who are not very well educated, who don't have much hope for the future. But it seems like changing that is just a very long-term process. And, well, it was going to take some kind of investment as well.
Well, you're right. I mean, the investment is crucial. The time's not, I mean, this is something, we can do some things pretty quickly. And by the way, the U.S. government's even started to show a somewhat different face. You know, after 10 years of not doing so, last week, President Bush paid our U.N. dues.
Right.
You know, he probably did that just because, you know, if we want some influence in the U.N., we better pay up our dues. But nonetheless, you know, for 10 years, we hadn't. You know, a year ago, we rejected the Kyoto Protocol on global warming. We walked out of Durban, the racism conference in South Africa, just a week before the terrorist attack. Now, that conference had been to some extent taken over by ideologues who had their own agendas. But again, America has to get used to dealing with these. You can't just walk out every time you don't like something. We walked away from the landmine ban treaties. We were getting ready to walk away from the ABM, the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty, on the way to missile defense. We rejected the new International Criminal Court at The Hague because it might compromise our sovereignty. I mean, there are a lot of things America can do pretty quick to put on a different face. We also can begin to think about, and you're right about the costs, to think about what it may cost to actually change the economic face of the world. And that's something we really have to begin to do, because, you know, half the world is under 16 years old right now, and a lot of those young people in the third world, and they're mostly in the South, not the North, are people for whom there's going to be very little hope if we don't create a juster economic order, if we don't start paying in the North for the ecological and environmental reforms we're asking southern nations of the South to undergo. You know, we don't want slave labor, we don't want environmentally polluting forms of production, but we don't want to pay for it. You know, we in America and in the West in the 19th century created our industrial order at the cost of the environment.
Right, but we don't expect China to act like we did.
Well, exactly, but why shouldn't they? Unless
right.
They get some help, and unless India gets some help, and Brazil gets some help, and Chile gets some help, and Indonesia gets some help from us in paying the cost. We're right to say the world can no longer afford your production methods the way we did it in the 19th century. But we have to say with that, but we understand that that would put impossible burdens on your economy. So we will make transfers of wealth from the north to the south that in effect pay for some of the measures you're going to take to protect not just your air and water, but our air and water as well. I don't really think, and this comes back to, you know, the earlier question about political will and we citizens, I don't think it's such a big jump. I mean, if we make the commitment that we want the WTO and the IMF and the UN and other world bodies to be governed by the principle that every international trade measure, every international treaty should be organized not about the protection of private investors, but the protection and redistribution of wealth in ways that allows the third world the same opportunities we had in the 18th and 19th century, I think you could see within a year or two some fairly profound changes. That would also secure America's safety against terrorists.
I know that one out of $8 was invested in socially responsible investing before this happened, or that was a figure from 1999. But are people on Wall Street thinking about this?
Well, you know what? They are now.
Right.
They might not have been before September 11th, but the silver lining in that dark, tumultuous, you know, hurricane cloud that came across the United States is that a lot of people are thinking about a lot of things that they weren't thinking about before. We all rightly are deeply concerned with the future safety of our children and of America and our air and water, and I think a lot of people have learned that that's not something you can just do with missile defense. Had we even had a successful missile defense shield, and most people think it's impossible to get one, but let's just say we had one, it wouldn't have done a thing to stave off these attacks, because the new interdependence of the world is the interdependence of AIDS, the interdependence of global prostitution and global crime rings, the interdependence of terrorism. And those things creep on little silent feet across our borders. They don't come in intercontinental ballistic missiles. And so we have to start addressing that part of the problem. And just as we very quickly after World War II, as an earlier caller very intelligently said, launched a massive Marshall Plan that within 5 years had reshaped and reconstructed the face of a war-devastated Europe, there's no reason why with the same political will, the same commitment of resources, we could not reshape the global order and make it an order that not only privileges economic interest in corporations and financial investors, but one that protects and indeed advances the interests of poor children in the third world, that creates environmental safety at with us contributing to the costs of it. I mean, that those things are not difficult to actually do. What's difficult is to secure the political will to do them.
I find it very ironic that, and perhaps sad, that we suddenly... Well, we've been doing this with Afghanistan before. I won't say that it's new, but we are going to give them lots of food aid. And ironically, I mean, I can't state what we should have done after the Kuwait War or when we should have ended it or whether we should have ended it at the border or at Baghdad. But, I mean, part of the great anger in the Arab world is about the starvation of the Iraqis, that now we have food to send to the Afghanis. I don't know how we can possibly... you know, bring down Saddam Hussein by giving them food, but if we could have done that before, we would be in a much better position now.
Right, and of course it's also the fact that when people are starving, you don't want to just give them apples, you want to help them plant apple trees so they don't need your donations and your philanthropy in the future. And America can't simply rely on philanthropy and trying to feed people because, you know, you feed people for a day and that's great, but tomorrow they're hungry again. You have to help them create their own self-sustaining economies, and you have to give them the wherewithal to create those economies in terms of an accommodating the standards of safety and child labor and environmental standards that you want to do, and that means you have to help them, you know, you have to help them pay for that. What you want to do is create a sustainable economic and a sustainable ecological order in those countries so that you don't have to send people care packages, but they can take care of themselves. And again, but I think, I mean, you know, the short term, sure, you send some care packages, but in the long term, I think a lot of people received a wake-up call. I mean, my fondest wish, I like so many Americans, I yearn for a real revenge on these horrendous terrorists who did what they did. But I can think of no better revenge than those terrorists sitting in hell, having discovered that, in fact, their martyrdom won them hell and not heaven, and seeing that the acts they committed, instead of bringing down America or turning us into a spiteful, arrogant military punisher, instead brought us to our senses and led in the long run to a more democratic world, a more just world, in which there was no place for terrorism. I mean, what a wonderful revenge on terrorism to make them irrelevant to the world.
Let's continue. Again, I hope the caller will forgive me of going on. We'll go to Jacksonville for next caller, line three. Hello.
How do you do?
Yes.
If you don't mind, before I say anything else, I did want to correct something that has just been said. The United States is importing a sizable percentage of our oil from Iraq in order to give them enough money so that there's absolutely no need for any kind of starvation to go on or anything remotely resembling it. The problem is that the leadership is not allowing the income to be used intelligently, and that's something that right now we don't have any control over. But what I really wanted to say was is that I think you kind of got into a situation where you have to realize that the free enterprise system, which certainly has treated me well, that's why I can be down here in Jacksonville, Florida, retired, is that the system is amoral, and so is government. Government has to be amoral. It has to look out for what is to its best advantage at all times. And until you can figure a system, which is going to take some philosophic study, to be honest with you, you're going to have to find something that modifies the free enterprise system so that it is no longer amoral. To have stockholders demanding, you know, quarterly increases in profits all the time is not an avenue to treat the rest of the world humanely. It's, when you think about it, it's probably counter to that. But until the rest of the world can economically be content with their lot, so to speak, in other words, their standard of living comes up, you're going to continue to have this hateful revenge motivations because they see people living quite well and they see themselves in abject poverty.
Well, you know where I appreciate what you say, and you're right about free enterprise, but I want to say that I don't think the difference between government and free enterprise is that one is supposed to be moral and the other isn't, whereas, as you say, neither can be moral. The difference is between public and private interests. You know that word republic, the American republic, comes from the old Latin for res publica, the things of the public. The difference between the market and government is that government is about our public, our common interests, our common ground, and free enterprise is about our private interests. In the free enterprise zone, we are producers and consumers. In the public ground, we are citizens. And the difference between citizens and consumers is the crucial difference here, because citizens think about their common interests, what we share, what we do together. And I think it is government's job in trying to embrace and discover and enforce our common interests to enforce the good of the public, the good of the commonwealth, the good of the common weal, on the private weal, on the private interests of the system. And my problem with the last 30 years is we've seen a default of the public sector. We have seen, in the name of an ideology of neoliberal privatization, we have seen the dismantling of the public sector, the dismantling of regulations. I mean, back in 1996, the precious public airwaves in the new technologies, which for so long had been seen as a public utility, were treated by the Clinton administration, my administration, I'm a Democrat, you know, as a private utility and turned over to the private sector completely. We privatized airport security and allowed these underpaid, untrained, illiterate guards to put the national safety in our hands. So I don't think we have to talk about moral versus immoral. What we want to talk about is public versus private, and the way that you control and civilize and humanize capitalism is by putting it under public authority, the commonwealth, the common views of public citizens working for the public good. And that, I think, is where we have gone wrong. So I don't think we have to worry about morality and the good guys here. We have to worry only about public interest trumping private interest instead of, as has happened for the last 25 years, private interest trumping public interest.
We have about 2 minutes, and I have three people holding, and I'm sorry to say I can't get you all in. I'm going to try to at least give one more person a chance. We'll go to Champagne and line one. Hello.
Yeah, I just want to say that I think that the speaker is very glib, and very hypocritical in his liberal approach. I can see why he went to the Clinton White House. I think he was bought off by the Clinton White House. And I think that this business about corporations not having moral responsibility is just a kind of liberal fascism.
Well, Professor Barber, you can respond.
Well,
I can give you about a minute or so.
Well, let's take one more question.
All human beings are responsible
instead of a rabid
animal. Morally to other human beings. Okay.
Let's get another call, please. I really don't want to respond to a Clinton.
Your liberalism is extremely shallow and extremely facile, and your way of responding to
people. I think we heard that the first time. Can we get another caller with a, you know, with a reasonable idea of his own or her own?
We try to like to give the callers an opportunity to have their say.
I'm glib. I'm facile. I'm a Clinton lover, and he's a Clinton hater. Good. Okay, let's move on.
All right. Well, let's go to Bloomington, Indiana. Then line number four. Hello.
Hi, I haven't heard of everything that you have said, Mr. Barber, this morning, but I haven't heard you mention Israel. In your whole analysis of the motivation of the terrorists, nothing said about Israel. Haven't you missed the point? How important is Israel?
Well, it's a good question, and obviously no discussion can take place without a discussion of Israel. We don't have time to talk about everything, but I do want to say that I believe that the underlying problems that nurture terrorism are not about Israel. The terrorists themselves, this particular group, are certainly exercised about Saudi Arabia and the American presence there and about the Palestinian-Israeli struggle. But in the long term, the circumstances that breed terrorism arise out of the character or of an international disorder. And I think if we don't focus on that, but instead simply make the Israeli-Palestinian conflict our struggle, we will simply get caught up in all of the dilemmas and contradictions of that struggle and find ourselves incapable of acting. I think if we act on the larger scene to construct a world that is more just and more democratic, we will find that, as has always been the case, the best answer to fascism, to communism, and to terror in the world is democracy.
We are going to have to stop, I'm sorry to say, but we're just at the end of the time. Professor Barber, we want to say to you, thanks very much for giving us some of your time today.
Thank you so much for this lively discussion.
We appreciate it. Our guest, Benjamin Barber, he's professor of civil society at the University of Maryland, principal of the Democracy Collaborative. His new book, Intellectual Affairs in the Clinton White House, titled The Truth of Power. It's published by Norton. And if you're interested in reading the book, Jihad versus McWorld, that book also is still available. It's published in paper by Ballantine Books.